This is Ford.
Mr. Ford?
Yeah, your car will be ready at 5 o'clock. Your V8 engine will be prepared by 5 o'clock. You'll be out of here. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. How about you?
Oh, hanging on. Okay. Are we on the air, or is this just like pre-recorded stuff?
This is pre-recorded.
Oh, okay.
By the way, the last car I ever owned with a V8 engine in it was my 68 Oldsmobile.
No kidding! Oh, wow. An Oldsmobile Starfire, 1955. Great car.
Mine was a Delta 88, 1968.
Oh, wow.
Anyway...
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, definitely. They don't make them that way anymore.
Yeah. They don't make a lot of things like they used to make.
Oh, don't even get me started.
Oh, well, yeah, we sound like guys with our feet up on a Cracker Barrel saying, well, I've seen them come and I've seen them go. But you know something? I have seen them go. I've seen them, the good things really go away, and that's not a good feeling.
Definitely not. Your latest recording features music by all the remaining members of The Doors, including the recently departed Ray Manzarek. Is that his last ever studio recording?
That was, well, yeah, that would have to be. But he also has been recording with his son, Pablo, up in Santa Barbara, so he might have done some scratch recording with Pablo. It's possible. But as far as a commercially released disc, I think this is it has to be the last time the three guys were together, together or separately, playing music. And how that came about was, pretty incredible too. So it's all kind of. Like I think it was, if I can give you just a brief calendar, I think it was 2011 is when I just laid down some scratch vocals. And John Densmore came into Hen House Studios to talk about his project, which was called Tribal Jazz. And he... was eavesdropping on what I had done, and Hen House had put on some cursory rhythm tracks, to kind of give just to give click time to what I'd recorded. And Densmore said, "Hey, I want to be on this record. I want to play drums on this record." And when I was talking to Ray. Ray said, "Well, I want to." I said, "Densmore recorded drum tracks in this," and Ray said, "I want to be on the record too." So, I asked him what would be the most comfortable room for him to record in. He said, "Studio D, in Sausalito," and we made a field trip to Studio D in Sausalito, and Ray laid down Hammond B3 tracks, clavinet tracks, Roland 88 tracks. Grand piano tracks on all the cuts that I'd recorded before. And a lot of this, was happening when I was in New Mexico. I was working in New Mexico, and before I'd left, Ray had said, "Why don't you get Robbie to play on this?" And so I talked to Robbie about 3 days before I left for New Mexico, and he said, "Well, you hear it. Let me just have a loop, and I'll listen to it." And long story short, I got back and called Robbie. I said, "What did you think of it, Rob?" And he said, "Well, I just laid guitar tracks on all your cuts, so that was the drill."
Each of the individual remaining Doors laid down their piece separately.
Yeah.
I understand you met Ray Manzarek in film school, and Jim Morrison, too.
Both of them, yeah, in Joseph von Sternberg's directing class. Can you imagine? The old man was lecturing at UCLA in the mid-1960s, And I was a non-registered student. I was illegally attending classes, walking into classrooms that I knew that I could learn something by being there. And I was in Don Ellis's harmony and theory class at Schoenberg Hall, and I was we both of us Morrison and I were in Jack Hirschman's poetry class, and you know it was just like one of those. Serendipitous moments. We were just there at the same time and just enamored of the same kind of film culture and the same kind of music culture. And we had found that we had so much in common, we became friends almost immediately. So that's the way that association that was the genesis of that association.
You almost became the Doors' bass player.
That's kind of not really, it's a little bit exaggerated. In my classic rock interview, if you read that, the true story is that Ray and I had a makeshift band called the White Trash Quintet, and we played at a place called Mother Neptune's, which was practically in L.A. City College's backyard. And I was playing a blonde K upright bass, and Ray was playing a thumbtack piano, and Ed Cassidy was playing drums. And if you remember, Ed Cassidy co-founded with his stepson Randy California a band called Spirit.
Oh, yes.
And that was the rhythm section. If you can imagine Morrison coming down and checking that out, it was sort of a trip. But there were two guys in the front line, a trumpet player named Don and a tenor player named Elliot. And both of them had done time with Frank Zappa.
Whoa.
They had workshopped with Zappa's rehearsal band. So you could actually say that these two horn players were woodshedding with the genesis of the Mothers of Invention.
Wow.
So that was really a rare moment. Now, when I was there in front of the Gypsy Wagon at UCLA when Jim and Ray officially co-founded the band with the name The Doors, and they were into rehearsing, I think, after pulling things together with John and Ravi. And Ray said, "Why don't you come down and sit in with us? We're going to have our bass player. Why don't you come down?" And I was on my way to Boise, Idaho. I had an interim lecture, my first college gig, so I told Ray, "Look, I think your idea of attaching a bass keyboard to the Vox organ is probably going to work." I said, "You know, you guys have to be four doors." I said, "Whoever heard of a five-door sedan?" you know, and that's how that works. So, no, I considered even stretching it. You know, there's nothing I just told you that it has any indication that I was invited to be a bandmate. You know, it just didn't. People like to romanticize that, but it really was more me saying, "You guys, you know, should be four doors, and let me go to Boise, Idaho, and see what kind of trouble I can get into," which I did. So that was it. But when I came back, I saw them at the Whiskey briefly, when I came back from Idaho, I looked up at this billboard on the Sunset Strip and saw emblazoned on the sign four familiar faces. You know, that was I said, "Hey, wait a minute, I know those guys." There was a big Elektra Records blurb that said the Doors break on through with an electrifying new album, and that was my first one. I said, "Well, so I reconnected with them. Every time I came back, I would always be leaving. I'd have assignments in different places, in New England, in Portland, and in Utah. And, you know, it was just, I was kept, every time I would come back, I would see the Doors on there, taking another step up toward their meteoric rise, you know. So that was kind of interesting.
You got to watch the phenomenon develop step by step.
Kind of, yeah. Yeah, looking at it that way, right. And I just... I think of what's going on here with the diverse sounds of these instruments. On it sounds like each track on the CD has its own personality. I became very aware of the diversity of instrumentation and the vast contributions being made through. Vocal chorus composing by executive producer Harlan Steinberger, and these wonderful melodic, almost Beach Boys kind of lyric composing by associate producer Tommy Jordan. And let's not forget the extra added attraction of lead voice from Fishbone Angelo, scatting like crazy. And I'm hearing all of these differences, and I felt a kind of you have to understand, I felt this urgent responsibility to try using different timbres, different phrasing, different intonations of my own on each of these 11 tracks, kind of using my voice as a separate instrument to more or less align, I guess, with especially what I was listening to coming from Manzarek and Densmore and Krieger.
If you'd like, I'd like to talk about a few of the poems that are on the record.
Oh, sure.
Okay, like, I Don't Want to Go, Said the Suicide. That seems to be about the present-day commercial music scene.
Kind of, yeah. There's a sort of a patina of recognition that music too often takes a left turn, and nobody really takes it seriously, you know, as a kind of a contamination of the culture. But I'm concerned with that, with a lot of what I write. I find myself reporting on the contamination of the film culture and music culture. The integrity of American cinema has just been obliterated, you know. So I'm kind of I find myself being a sort of a cultural reporter, in a sense. See myself as investigative, in a way. So that's one example of it, I guess. But it's also talking about the poet's suicide leaping off the bridge between St. Paul and Minneapolis. So there's a kind of a connection between the demise of the poetic imagination and the demise of musical imagination. You got to admit, it's not the 60s anymore. And these guys that are on this record were, a lot of people consider them emblematic to the turbulent 1960s. And I don't mean to sound like a nostalgic on acid, but, you know, there is something to that. Does that clarify anything?
Yes, it definitely does. the slime that's taken over the music business seems to have taken over the whole entertainment sector.
You get that feeling, don't you, sometimes?
I get that feeling a lot.
Well, it's, you know, radio heads like you take a risk and send whatever messages I've got out into the ozone. And I do, you know, when you're dealing with confrontation, you can get into some trouble because you take a poetry slam mentality and you start yelling and cursing and accusing and alleging and it gets a little bit crazy. So what I have to constantly catch myself in the middle of, maybe getting into that kind of trouble, I have to make sure that I have allegiance to the language, that I have a responsibility to language art, and then the political rhetoric can kick in. So sure, yeah, I want to send a message, but I don't necessarily want the message to be fired from a bazooka. I don't want the message to necessarily be tied to a time bomb. You know, I think I can say what I need to say and reveal some truths that maybe didn't get reviewed with too much clarity before, and working at it from working into the message sideways rather than just confronting it head on.
Using a screwdriver instead of a sledgehammer.
It's sort of, yeah. But I don't want to record an Oliver Stone movie. You know, he makes all of his movies with a sledgehammer, doesn't he? He's just pounding people over the head with Vietnam and the Kennedy assassination. I think it's healthy to have that, you know, exposure. But he really he doesn't take any prisoners when he makes a movie, does he? That guy.
Not that I've seen.
No.
Speaking of war and taking prisoners, track number 9, Wartime Carol, you begin with then-President George Bush throwing up on the Prime Minister of Japan.
Oh, yeah, that was just the way it started, and I didn't want to, it's not a Bush-bashing poem necessarily. What it is, it's saying, this is American politics, folks, and you got to live with it. You know, and we've learned from all of the political changes just in the last 8 years how mistaken voters can be sometimes. You know, so yeah, it's not so much the vocal refrains are designed to complement my original text. And it does reinforce that political negativity. Why do you feel that it's you feel there's something that needs to be addressed there?
No, I think you covered it pretty well.
Oh, okay.
You edited a literary magazine in the mid-70s called the Sunset Palms Hotel. How did that come about?
The Sunset Palms Hotel came about with a public relations director at Atco Records, Bill Yarian, said, I want to start a magazine. And you did that Mount Alverno Review anthology, created it for a surgery fund, to raise money for a surgery fund in Palo Alto, which is true. And he said, you know how to do books. Why don't you help me do this magazine? And he had a friend, someone I knew from United Artists Records. He was, I believe he was the music editor of FM Coast and Fine Arts magazine. And so he called Bill and said, you guys can come over here and use all the mailing equipment at the magazine. So that's how we kind of got around the outrageous expenses for producing a literary magazine. And I said, what do we want to call this magazine? And he said, well, let's get a Raymond Chandler vibe to it, you know, kind of a Southern California depression kind of feeling about it. So he decided to call it the Sunset Palms Hotel. And I said, yeah, sure. And we everybody that we publish can sort of have a room in the hotel. You know, kind of have a free room in the hotel, and I remember Robert Kelly writing from Bard College. He said, "I don't need a room in your hotel. Just let me be a nut wandering around in the lobby." So it did inspire a lot of creative responses from writers that I brought into that catalog of, I guess it was seven issues of the Sunset Palms Hotel appeared between 1973 and 1983. So it made its literary mark, I think. Did you ever get a chance to eavesdrop on any of those issues at all?
No, this is the first time I've ever heard of the Sunset Palms Hotel.
I should... email me your snail mail address, and I'll mail you a copy.
Okay, deal. Thank you. I appreciate this very much.
Okay.
You were influenced by jazz poet Kenneth Patchen. Did you ever actually meet him?
Patchen was my teacher. This is a long story because it involves an emporium that used to be called the Crenshaw Theater on Jefferson and Crenshaw. To shorten that whole story, Jack Hampton, who was a Beverly Hills agent and who later ran against Tom Hayden in the Peace and Freedom Party ticket for Santa Monica Assembly, decided in 1958 that he would create something that would subsidize the arts. He would create a stage where all of these musicians could create sort of a mini Newport Jazz Festival is what he wanted to do. So he brought, in essence, his idea of a smaller version of the Newport Jazz Festival into the LA Jazz Concert Hall. And I was hitchhiking to high school. I was hitchhiking down Crenshaw Boulevard, and I got a ride to Jefferson, and I looked up at this marquee, and it said Buddy DeFranco, Ben Webster, Jackie and Roy, Cal Jader, Shelly Mann and his boys, Shorty Rogers and his Giants. Well, these are guys that I was hearing their music on the radio when I was 14 years old. I was listening to their music being played by a guy named Gene Norman on KLAC between 10 o'clock and midnight. And so I walked in and I saw this. It was like I had an epiphany. You know, it was amazing. Then Hampton dropped the message on all of us that he was going to bring the poets down from San Francisco. He was going to bring the San Francisco Renaissance. He brought the Newport Jazz Festival in that first year. The second year, he was going to bring in the San Francisco Renaissance poets. And he did. Kenneth Rexroth came in and read. I studied with him backstage informally, but it was like going to a guerrilla street university. You know, I'm sitting, he's giving me this list, this reading list. He said, "You got to read these books," and I never went back to high school. To tell you the absolute truth, I just went down to the library on Fifth and Hope in downtown L.A. and sat in the basement and read all these books that Rexroth told me to read. And when Rexroth left, he said, "Wait till you meet Kenneth Patchen. He's coming down. He's coming down in a couple of months." And Patchen came in and stayed practically a year, and I studied with him all that time. And he brought with him these incredible musicians, associated with the music department at Stanford University, but the Chamber Jazz Sextet was certainly a band unlike any band that I have ever heard in my lifetime. And they were backing up this poet with an unbridled imagination and a moral outrage. And that's why I picked up probably a lot of his morality. I picked up a lot of it from Kenneth. And so my association with Patchen was pure gold, and I probably wouldn't be standing in the middle of this Hen House Studios plant, which is where I am right now, and be doing what I'm doing if it wasn't for Patchen.
That is fascinating. That is like, wow, I don't quite know how to respond to that.
Well, you must have read him then. He must be part of your library somewhere.
I've listened to his work. I listened to his folk
ways. Oh yeah, sure, you did. Yeah, he recorded three or four times.
I wasn't aware that he had more than one album. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, he has an album on folkways where he's reading with a jazz quintet from Canada. And then he has another Folkways album where he's just reading, dry reading. And then, of course, that wonderful Chamber Jazz Sextet album that he did, which is legendary. And it was on the Cadence label. Now, the weird little sidebar to that is, who bought Cadence Records? Who got the Patchen Chamber Jazz Sextet record album in their vault? Andy Williams. Now, what is Andy Williams going to do with Patchen reading with the Chamber Jazz Sextet? Evidently nothing. It's still sitting there somewhere. So
that's criminal not to have that stuff.
Oh, yeah, you know, there are terrible stories about Bobby Troup's Stars of Jazz. When Stars of Jazz was on ABC, they had these wonderful programs, Billie Holiday, the Lighthouse All-Stars, Chet Baker's Quartet, the Modern Jazz Quartet. Everybody you can think of who was legendary at that time appeared on Stars of Jazz. What do you think they did with the majority of the VHRs, whatever they had at the time? What do you think they did with those tapes? The Stars of Jazz tapes with all those legends. What do you think they did?
Please tell.
They photographed episodes of Who's the Boss over. They used it for episodes of Who's the Boss. Now you think about that for a minute.
They erased them.
They have erased all but maybe, I think maybe six or seven remain. I might be wrong on that number, but Not much more is left. And I was down there. I knew Bobby and Julie, and I was down there many times, and I saw these people, and I was, you know, I could reach out and shake their hands if I dared to do something like that at that age, which I did, and I was just very quiet and in awe of all of this. If you read my interview in that classic rock section, I guess all you have to do is go to classic rock online and you'll pick up the interview. I talk about all of that, a lot of that. Not with the same kind of narration that I'm giving you now, but it's a lot of the essence of that is there. So
that makes me so sick. What a studio won't do to save a few bucks on tape.
Oh, unbelievable. But to take a show like that, classic music like that, and just erase it, it's unbelievable. I rolled over it. Patchen read with Charles Mingus at the Living Theater in New York, just a couple of months after he left the LA Jazz Concert Hall. And think about it. Mingus, Jazz Workshop, Patchen reading at the Living Theater, nobody rolled tape. Nobody recorded it.
Not even a bootlegger.
Well, there was a some guy maybe with a Wallen sack reel to reel sitting there in an aisle, messing around with it, and I think a couple of pieces got recorded. But where they are, I don't know. I heard KPFK found one and played it when I did the tribute to Patchen in 73, I guess it was. So that was something else, huh?
Something else indeed. If I recall correctly, your first album of poetry was on Greg Ginn's SST label. How'd you connect?
That's right, it was. It was on SST, and there was it was actually bankrolled by Mike Watt, the bassist and leader of Minutemen. You know Minutemen? They were kind of a post-punk alternative band, and their shtick was all of their tunes lasted only a minute, and then they were done. They lasted a minute, and they recorded their albums, have like about 36 tracks on it, you know, that kind of thing. So Mike Watt and I appeared in a benefit for KXLU Radio at the Laza Club in downtown Hollywood. And Watt said, you know, why don't you do a record with us? I said, okay. We got all of these studio radio station visits, and a lot of that record is 90% radio station visits. I don't think there's any in studio stuff on that disc, but it is. You got to understand something. It's 12-inch LP vinyl, the same as Patchen's record, 12-inch LP vinyl. I was part of that tradition, and that made me feel good.
I can imagine it would. I'm glad you finally landed on vinyl.
Yeah, and guess what? Hen House is producing 500 12-inch LPs as special serials, collections, library material. But I will actually have another 12-inch LP. Thanks to Hen House doing having that format added to the CD, in other words. So, wow.
Yeah, the LP is coming back.
Somebody mentioned that. What's your take on that? Have you seen evidence of real 12-inch LP product being put out there?
Well, it's not the way it used to be, of course, but there's a record store up in Ithaca called Records, which looks like a time warp back to like 1975. I mean, they do have CDs, but it's mostly vinyl.
Yeah, right. Well, of course, you've got those retro shops. You know, you can go into Amoeba and see 12-inch LPs on the wall for $180, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, it's just crazy.
You can find $150 records at too, but most of them are considerably more reasonable.
Oh, really? Good. I'm glad to hear that.
You have a poem on YouTube about the origins of jazz drumming with John Densmore backing you up.
Oh, that was a project that brought me to Hen House. In 2002, Densmore and I decided we would do, part of an education program at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, we would do a history of drumming. We would pay tribute to the percussion players that were part of it, and I would just lay down a narrative on American drumming. And that, I wrote it, and the percussion conduit that we were supposed to plug into at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame got terminated. He was no longer there, so we were sitting there with this, and Hen House, you know, how adventurous they are and how enterprising they are. They immediately recorded the thing and videotaped it, and that's what you're watching. You're watching the video, and there is a recording exists too somewhere, but you see it on video. That's the result of our endeavor to educate people in Pittsburgh, but it just didn't happen. So we're educating people who are watching the thing on the computer screen, I guess. I mean, I would hope so.
That includes quite a few people.
Oh, good.
By the way, I love the line that appears at the very end of that poem. It gives a headache to the guards of cultural restraint.
Oh, yeah. I think just another sort of indication that our foray into the culture to improve it is somehow restrained by the media power structure, who doesn't actually want to be bothered with it. So it is a cultural restraint on that level.
Did you ever do poetry readings at Doors gigs?
Oh, myself? No. The only time I read, my very first reading, you probably, as part of my history, so you probably know this, the very first time I read out loud in front of people was with Morrison at a benefit to raise money for Norman Mailer, who was running for the mayor of New York City. Andy Warhol had done this huge benefit for Norman Mailer, raise money so he could become the mayor of New York, and here was his campaign promise. He promised that if he was made mayor of New York, he would turn Manhattan into like another country. He would secede from the Union, and Manhattan would be like Canada or Mexico. And Morrison just said, we got to do this. This is pure buffoonery. We have to do this. So Andy Warhol people came out and marshaled Morrison into service. And we ended up at the Cinematheque Theater on Sunset Boulevard, which is now Book Soup, an independent bookstore. Interesting that that movie house turned into a bookstore. But that's what happened. And so there I am on a bar stool and next to Morrison, and Robbie was playing guitar a little bit, noodling a little bit on playing single string, soloing on guitar. And we invited our poetry teacher, Jack Hirschman, to come from UCLA. And by then he'd been fired, actually. I think he was fired by the English department. For reasons that are so typical, I think, and it's, they're almost toxic. The poet in residence at the time had 5 people in his class, and Hirschman had 130. So never become more popular than the poet in residence at a college. Never do that. That's it. So Morrison, we invited Hirschman, and Hirschman came down and read, and all to raise money for Norman Mailer. That was, you know, like something that was not to be, I guess.
Something that was not to be, but which made a statement.
Oh, it certainly did. As beautifully absurd a statement as it was a statement that was a part of that time, the turning of the decade. You know, it was perfect. 1969, June of 1969. So there it was.
Are there any points that you'd like to cover before we wrap up?
Oh, nothing really. I just wanted to maybe mention there's a lot of Southern California damage being reviewed on this record. And one might almost say in a pathological manner. I think it's the history of the decimation of various elements of art and architecture and mindless destruction of traditional landmarks. I'm sure that East Coasters will love the fact, oh, listen to this guy, he's ragging on Los Angeles, you know. But it's Los Angeles is just a metaphor. And I think you know that. The corruption of the music culture we talked about, the obliteration of any discernible integrity in modern cinema, it isn't going to inspire good feelings, but except with East Coasters who like the idea that L.A. is being observed by me on that level. But in my imagination, I have to tell you that, again, it seems to be a responsibility to report the assault on our senses. And I guess that's what I'm doing.
I'm thinking about the poem, Whatever Happened to the Orange Groves, Grandma?
Oh, my aunt and uncle actually owned, they were renting a house in the middle of an orange grove, and they participated in the orange show in San Bernardino, and they crated, their label was Upland Oranges, and you know, the orange crate labels are notorious now, they're selling for an exorbitant amount of money, you know, if you can find them. But their backyard was orange trees practically all the way to Claremont. And I saw the bulldozers come in and start mowing down those trees. And I thought, this doesn't look right. You know, it doesn't seem like, of course, at that, you know, you just kind of accepted it. But I had no idea until much later that it was a conspiracy between the real estate robber barons and the San Bernardino City Council. They needed money. They wanted more money. And real estate is, as you know, like war. War and real estate are the biggest money makers in America. Awful policies, but still, that's what's going on. Anyway, really great talking to you. It's a terrific dialogue, and thank you for being there.
Well, thank you very much for granting me this interview, and have a great day, and good luck with whatever is happening at Hen House Studios.
Okay, kiddo. Thanks a lot.
Hey, have a good one.
And you do. Bye.